is, you know, you can perceive, a lot of times we use the word feel his presence. But what we mean is you can perceive when he's in the room. There's something called the omnipresence of God, which means God is everywhere present. But then there's something that is the manifest presence of God. That's when we say, well, God showed up. And I sense the presence of God here this morning. Amen. Do you? Yeah. Yeah. And it's beautiful to see and in how he is, how you are responding to God through worship and prayer. And this morning we got another example of how much we need God. Last week, the series we're going through is that we need the same God that Jacob needed, the same God Moses needed, the same God David needed. He's the same God, and we need him in our lives today. So last week we looked at Jacob in the book of Genesis, who needed God, and he needed him so badly that he wrestled with God. He wouldn't go to sleep. He stayed up all night, and God revealed himself to him, and he wrestled with God through the night, and he wouldn't let God go. He needed him, and he wouldn't let God go. And today we're going to look at the story of Moses and how Moses and Israel also needed God. But before we get into that, we need God in our lives. We're reminded of that just now. And when we're facing something that is a challenge, the bigger the challenge we're facing, the more we pray. And obviously, I think there was a moment in the service today where we were all praying, but there was a moment in the service when we all, I guess we could say we really were praying, right? Or we really started to just cry out to God, not knowing exactly what was going on. And we need God not just today because of things that happen, but things like this happen in our lives all the time, whether it's illness or our families, our marriages. We may not all be in a moment right now where we're needing God in our marriage, but some of us are, and some of us, we either have, or we are, or we will, right? Where we are crying out to God, saying, God, if you don't show up, I don't know what's going to happen to my marriage. If you don't show up, God, I don't know what's going to happen to my children. They're walking so far away from you. And I've been challenged this week with Jacob and asking God, or the Holy Spirit really prompting in me, are you praying for your children the way Jacob prayed? Am I grabbing on to God and not letting go until he answers and brings my children in a right relationship with him? Whatever the need is, are you wrestling with God and not letting God go? And we need him in our lives. We need him in the world, in our nation. The CDC finds, this is a headline, CDC finds the depression epidemic among teens. And this is referring to the pandemic. That it's an epidemic among teens in the last 2 years. But even before that, New York Times was talking about a study that was done up to 2019. So this was before the shutdown, before the pandemic. 60% increase in rates of major depression in teenagers. 60%. And I tell you, this week, as I was preparing this, and I was reading these articles, because we need to understand how serious this is. You go into the article, and it mentions across the board, kids in all 50 states, teenagers in particular, because the pandemic has raised levels of depression and suicide among adults as well. But before the pandemic, there was already a 60% increase in depression and sadness and hopelessness among kids, teenagers. They need God. So as I was reading these articles, the phone rings and someone calls, and Christy comes into my office and says, do you have time to talk to someone? Not someone from the church, someone that got our number, who felt like they just couldn't go on anymore. So they called someone, they called the church in Arizona, I think it was, another state that then gave them our number, and then this person called. But it was right as I was reading this. I mean, I tell you, no sooner I had read some of these articles and headlines and then was going back to the sermon preparation that the phone rings. And those are moments when God, I think, just wants to, again, you know, the exclamation point, hey, this is serious. So we need God in our city. This is another headline that someone shared with me. Syracuse ranked number one for highest child poverty in the nation. Among cities of 100,000 or more, ranked number one. And it's not that we just became the number one city in child poverty. We've been the number one city in child poverty since 2015. So at least the last 7 years. So we need God. We've needed God. But are we really crying out to God, saying, God, this needs to change? Well, when we cry out to God because of what we're facing, it will turn at times, you know, in the book of Exodus here, we're going to see that it uses the word groaning a lot. The people of Israel were groaning. And that's a different level of prayer, isn't it? Not just asking, groaning. But there's a difference between groaning prayer and grumbling prayer. I think sometimes we think we're groaning when really what we're doing is grumbling. God, if that man doesn't straighten up, you know, I'm like, why did you give me these kids, God? I mean, why is my life the way it is, God? And we're not really groaning, we're grumbling. And I bring that up because we're going to see, if you know much about the story of Israel, they groaned, but then their groaning turned into grumbling. And God responds to the groaning prayers and cries of his people very well, with compassion, with concern. But he doesn't respond very well or very favorably to grumbling. So open up with me to Exodus chapter 1. We're going to pick up the story. Exodus chapter 1, and we're going to see when we cry out to God because of what we are facing, we need to be willing to face and some different things that we're going to see in the story of Moses and Israel, that because they were facing persecution and they cried out to God, they were facing that God, because of this trial, because of this that we are facing, we cry out to you, but then they were going to face different challenges and opportunities. So to pick up or to bridge from where we were last week, for those who were here or weren't here, Jacob, we talked about Jacob last week. I mentioned him already. Well, God had promised Jacob that he was going to make him into a great nation through Abraham, his grandfather, then Isaac, then Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons, and those 12 sons become the 12 tribes of Israel. And because of a famine, they ended up going into Egypt, which is where Exodus begins. It's been 430 years or so, and they've been in Egypt this entire time. At first, everything was great. They were loved, they were welcomed, they were appreciated, because God used Jacob's son Joseph to save the nations, to save Israel, but also even to save Egypt and to make Egypt incredibly wealthy and powerful. It was already a powerful nation, but it became an incredibly wealthy and powerful nation for this time. So at first, everything was great. They were given the best of the land to settle in. But over time, here's where we pick it up in Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. And it says, then a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have come too far, and the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies. Fight against us and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh labor and brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. Right? So they're working them, ruthless, right? Merciless. But verse 22 tells us exactly how ruthless they were. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile. But let every girl live. So it gets to a point, in order to control their growth, the multiplication of the Israelites, Pharaoh commands the murder of every male child that is born. This is brutality. This is murder. And, you know, the hard work was hard. I'm sure they grumbled or they cried out to God because they were having to work so hard. And the Egyptians probably, it wasn't like they were getting a fair wage or anything. They were being mistreated. But you can imagine the groaning of those mothers when their babies were ripped out of their arms and thrown into the Nile to drown. You can imagine that groaning reaching God's ears. Well, it did reach God's ears. And in Exodus chapter 2, verse 23, God responds. It says, during the long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites with concern about them and was concerned about them. So God looks at them with concern. We see this as comes up again in the next chapter. So God responds to the deep groaning cries of his people, of his children. Now, when this happens, when God responds to them, the first thing that they need to face is themselves, or in Moses' case, himself. So we have to face ourselves. So let me kind of bring you up here up to speed on what's happening with Moses. When all those babies were being thrown into the Nile because they were born, some moms tried to save their son. Obviously, every mom tried to save their son. Well, one of them was Moses' mother. She was pregnant. She gave birth, and it was a son. Now, she already had an older son named Aaron, and she had a daughter named Miriam. Now she's born, and now is when they've commanded all the boys need to be thrown into the Nile. So Moses is born, and before they realize it, she puts him in a basket and puts him in the Nile, but not just, you know, in a basket to just send him and see what happens. She had a plan. She puts little baby Moses in this basket very near where the palace and the daughters of Pharaoh would go and bathe and go and sit along the side of the Nile. So when the basket comes floating, they grab the basket, open it up, it's a baby. Well, as soon as they do that, Miriam and Moses' mom are very close by. They're watching this. And as soon as they see that Pharaoh's daughter pulls Moses out of the water, Miriam goes running up and says, oh, that's one of the Hebrew babies. Do you want me to go find a Hebrew mom to nurse him and take care of him until he, you know? So she said, yeah, do that. So she goes and gets her own mom, Moses' mom, and brings her to Pharaoh's daughter, and his mom begins to take care of him until he's old enough to be able to be a part of Pharaoh's household. So that's where, so Moses then, as he's growing up, he knows he's not an Egyptian. We don't know exactly at what age he found out, but we know that he, at least at the age of 40, he knew he was not an Egyptian. I tend to think he probably knew it very early on. One, his facial features and probably a little bit different. But also, kids are, I mean, can you imagine? The Hebrews weren't seen very well or liked very well. So all of his other adopted cousins, all of Pharaoh's real children and grandchildren, do you think they treated him nicely? Do you think they didn't let him know that he was a Hebrew? That oh, yeah, you're the one that we rescued. You know, you're the stray my mom found in the river. So at some point, though, he knew, and I think it was probably fairly early on. And as a result, he's about 40 years old now, and he wants to do something for his people. So he goes and he sees an Egyptian beating up and mistreating Hebrews. So when nobody's looking, he kills that Egyptian. And he thought he got away with it, but he didn't get away with it Pharaoh finds out about it, so Moses has to run for his life. And he runs all the way to the land of Midian, which is today Saudi Arabia. So all the way across the Sinai Peninsula, all the way into what today is Saudi Arabia, and he's living there, and he's been living there for 40 years. He's got a wife, he's got kids, he's a shepherd now. He's 80 years old. And here's where we pick it up in chapter 3, verse 4. God appears to him in a burning bush, and then Moses goes to see this bush that's on fire but isn't being consumed. And in verse 4, when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am," here I am. "Do not come any closer," God said. "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." Then he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And at this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And then the Lord says, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a land that is good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites." And again, he says, "Now the cry has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out." So first thing Moses has to do is face himself and what he's done. This is a chapter he thought was closed, right? He had put that way behind him. And he needs to now face the consequences of his mistakes, right? I believe God had a plan for Moses from the beginning. I mean, we know that. I think Moses believed that too. I think that when his mom was taking care of him for those first few years of his life, he not only got to learn how to speak Egyptian and study Egyptian, but he learned how to speak Hebrew. My oldest son, when we lived in right after he was born our last semester of college, and we lived those last 2 months in college, and then we moved back down to South Florida, and we lived close to my parents. And my mom, if you guys know this, she only speaks Spanish. She does not speak English. So she was grandma. She was nanny. Like, when we would go to work, she would watch our son Jared. 2 years later, we moved to Atlanta to start the church in Atlanta. So he was 2 years old. As soon as we got to Atlanta, our second son, Caleb, was born. And then we've had other children. To this day, Jared can speak Spanish. He can. When we were just down for my mom's 80th birthday, right, and we were all there, here he is in the kitchen speaking to my mother in Spanish. We had some cousins come from Costa Rica, and he was talking to them in Spanish. And it just surprises me what just being around my mom for those first 2 years during her as the babysitter, watching him, how that affected his ability to now today still speak a language at 27. So I'm pretty sure Moses, if he was with her for 3 to 4, most likely about 4 years, that he learned that. And plus he would hear the stories, right, of the promises, the covenant of how God spoke to Abraham, and then the story of Isaac and of Jacob, and how they had been brought into Egypt because of the famine, but that God made a promise to lead them back into the land of Canaan. And I'm sure she probably whispered into his ear, "You know, God has placed you, Moses, in Pharaoh's palace, in Pharaoh's household. He has placed you in a position where one day you might be able to help your people." Again, I'm just thinking, but I would imagine that's possible. And so at 40 years old, maybe he's, you know, we know that he wasn't a great speaker. He says he kind of stuttered some. He wasn't very eloquent. Maybe he never really stepped up. Who knows? Maybe he's 40 and he's like, "Come on, it's 40 years old. I haven't done anything yet." So he does something, but he does the wrong thing. And because of what he did, he ended up having to leave, and he's thinking, "I failed. I messed up. That's it." And when God shows up, he has all of that comes back up again. And some of what we're crying out to God for, some of what we're facing in our marriages or our lives or our situation, we have to face our part in whatever's going on. Right? We have to face that, you know, this isn't, oh, it's not God's fault. It's not somebody else's fault alone. Some of it might be, but what's my part? So he had to face himself. Not only did he have to face his past and his mistakes and the shame that came from that, he had to face his own identity and who he was. Let's keep reading in verse 10. But now Moses, God tells him, now go, right? Go to Egypt to set my people free. And in verse 11, Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Right? And God says, I will be with you, and this will be a sign to you. Right? So, but his first response again is telling, right? Who am I? I mean, God, I mean, who am I that you would call me? And I think he's thinking about, again, all the mistakes that he's made, all the problems he's done, all the things he's done wrong. There's got to be some better people, God. Not me. Right? Who am I? So God says, he brings it back to himself. I will be with you. And he had to face his inadequacies, his weaknesses. So look in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 13. So Moses said, you know, suppose I go. So he's trying to get out of it. Here's a little bit of the grumbling, right? Suppose I go and the Israelites say, and I say to them, God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask, what is your name? What should I tell them? And then in chapter 4, so he's making excuses, trying to get excuses here. Moses answered in chapter 4, verse 1. Moses answered, well, what if they don't believe me or listen to me and say the Lord did not appear to you? Right? So he's coming up with excuses. He's like, God, you know, well, what if? Hoping that God will somehow change his mind, right? And then he gets a little more bold in chapter 4, verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I have never been eloquent. Neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. And I love God's answer, right? The Lord said to him, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes the deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. But Moses said again, pardon me, right? Pardon me. Pardon your servant, please send someone else. Now this is, you know, God's getting a little frustrated. We said he doesn't like grumbling or complaining. So here in verse 14, the Lord's anger burned against Moses. And he says, what about your brother Aaron, the Levite? Again, he doesn't let him off the hook. But Moses is obviously feeling inadequate for good reason. Not only his past, but here he says, I'm not a good speaker. I'm not good in front of people. I kind of stumble over my words, maybe even a stuttering impediment. And God is calling him. So he's feeling completely inadequate. But I want you to see something. All of these issues that Moses has, the fact that he killed someone, the fact that he messed up, the fact that even his decisions, the consequences that he hasn't seen his mom for 40 years, right? I mean, his decisions have hurt him. Even though he's not a great speaker, those issues seem to only be issues for Moses. God isn't bringing them up. God isn't saying, well, Moses, you know, I would use you, but you kind of don't speak that well, you know? Or Moses, I would use you, but, you know, you're 80 now. You're kind of, you know, maybe at 40 I could have, but, I mean, these are issues that Moses is bringing up, not God. And it makes me think how often we are the ones that are bringing up issues, or we have things that we think disqualify us, that God can't use me because of. But God, his grace covers those things. He uses us in spite of who he is, of who we are, and because of who he is. As I was thinking about this morning, I remembered an evangelist, a Baptist evangelist named David Ring. And he has... The reason he always impressed me is because he has cerebral palsy, which affects, you know, his motions, his posture, his speech. It even affects the intellectual ability. It causes seizures. I mean, cerebral palsy is a very, very difficult disorder. And this man, with all of his difficulty, with all of his challenges, felt God calling him to preach. And he became a preacher, a motivational speaker. I mean, all the reasons why he would not be qualified to do this, right? But he does. And he's known for this line. This is a phrase that he would say as he would introduce himself. He would say, "I have cerebral palsy. What's your problem?" And I think what he meant was, what's your excuse? I have cerebral palsy. What's your excuse? So, as he's going through this, Moses is having to face all of these issues, all of his life, his inadequacies, and his past. Another thing we might have to face is our fears. We may have to face our fears. So let's go, let me just fast forward, because we're going to jump all the way up now into Exodus chapter 14. What's going on in the next few chapters, Moses does go back with his brother Aaron. He confronts Pharaoh and says, God has sent me to tell you to let his people go so they may go out to worship him. And Pharaoh says no. Sometimes he says yes, but he quickly turns back again and says no, changes his mind. So God commands Moses to send 10 plagues, one at a time, on Egypt. The first one was the water into blood. The Nile River turned into blood, and then there were gnats, there were frogs, there was darkness, there was hail, there were boils, and he gets all the way to the 10th plague, which is the one that finally broke the will of Pharaoh and the Egyptians, which was the death of the firstborn. Everyone who did not take the blood of a lamb, representing Jesus, the blood of the lamb, and put it on their doorpost, the angel came over the city, and on every home who did not have the blood covering the doorpost, the firstborn in that home died. And that looks, again, it's very, very hard, right? We look at that and think how hard that is, that judgment. But then we go back to what they were doing to Israel and all the firstborn and all the boys that were killed. So those plagues happen. We get to the 10th plague. Pharaoh finally says, okay, and he lets them go, so they leave. And that's where we get in Exodus chapter 14, verse 1. So the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea. And they are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal-Zephon. Pharaoh will think that the Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and he will pursue them, but I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. So the Israelites did this. So they're on their way out of Egypt. God tells them to turn back around and camp near the Red Sea. And so they have the sea on one side in front of them, and they have the desert. They're hemmed in, right? They're cornered because now Pharaoh is coming with his army. And here's where we go in verse 10. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. And they were terrified, and they cried out to the Lord. So there's the fear that they have to face of what's coming after them, right? Of Pharaoh coming to get them, of their torturer, of their abusers now coming to finish the job. But look at how they respond. It says they cried out. But tell me if this sounds more like groaning or grumbling. They said to Moses, was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. So they're grumbling at least towards Moses. Moses answers the people, do not be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. So here's the interesting thing. So he tells them, okay, they're crying out, maybe more grumbling than groaning, but they're crying out. And Moses' instructions to them is, hey, you'll see God's hand move powerfully. You just only need to be still. Now, hundreds of years later, David, in the Psalms, it says, be still and know that I am God. So that's true. There are moments when we need to be still and know He's in control, that He is God. So hundreds of years earlier, that's what Moses tells the people. Be still. Just all you need to do is be still. Well, God responds, and He says, then Moses said, the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Wait a minute, I thought that was a good thing, right? To cry out to God. But here He says, why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Right? He's telling them, be still. And God is saying, tell the people to keep moving. Irwin McManus on this, from a book called The Last Arrow and from Messages with that book, talks about this moment. And he says, "What the way I see it is when you're about to go back, when you're about to give in, when you're looking at your, when the past is coming after you and you're tempted to go back, stop. Be still. Don't go backwards. But if you're moving forward into the future that God has promised for you, keep moving forward." Moses had to face this and the people, because what was on the other side of the Red Sea, the Promised Land, their future was unknown to them. It was change. It was different. At least Egypt, they knew. Right? At least they knew what that was like. They may not have liked it, but they knew it. What was coming, they didn't even know. So Moses, when God calls Moses, Moses doesn't want to move. He wants to be still. He wants to stay put. He wants to be right where he is. And Irwin McManus mentions, he says, listen, tomorrow is coming no matter what. But your future is waiting for you. I mean, tomorrow's coming, no matter what. Tomorrow will come. But your marriage is only going to change if you act. Your poverty is only going to be affected positively if the church and if people move forward. If we just keep looking at it, if we kept just saying, oh, that's too bad, but we do nothing about it, we just stay still, 5 years from now, we'll be looking again and saying, yep, Syracuse is still number one in child poverty. Because even though we know it, we stayed still. So they need to face the future, the fear of what's coming, the fear, you know, face it and move forward. There's a time to act and there's a time to be still. And this was a time for them to act. And the third thing they face is God. When you ask God to deliver you from the trials you are facing, one of the things that you will end up facing is God. Now, initially when Moses saw God, what did he do? He hid his face. He was afraid. He hid his face. When the Israelites, through Moses, first met God, and they go after the Red Sea, they go to the mountain, and God's presence descends in fire on the top of the mountain, and they are terrified. There's thunder, there's lightning. They're like, this is frightening. And Moses goes up into the mountain and encounters God. And Moses goes from hiding from the glory of God to revealing the glory of God. Right? After he prays, he's so close to God that after he prays, when he walks out, his face would glow. And he had to cover it up because people, he didn't want to look at God, people didn't even want to look at Moses because of the glory that was coming from Moses. So he goes from hiding from God's glory to revealing it. He goes from hiding his face to seeking God's face. He cries out to God and says, he goes from groaning for deliverance to longing for intimacy. See, at first it started with, God, we need you. God, deliver us. God, set us free. But then it became not groaning, but longing. Groaning, normally, when you think about groaning, you're thinking, okay, something bad. You're groaning because of the stress, because of the trial. But when you think longing, you think of the desire for something good. Groaning for something to be delivered from something bad, but longing is the desire for something good. It's like that soldier, that sailor, that Marine who's been deployed for 6 months, and he's just longing to see his bride again. just longing to hold his kids, right? He's just longing for that day to come when he can be back with his family. When we cry out to God, God's desire is not just to handle whatever we're facing, but it's to allow us to see his face, to know him. And what we want to be here in my life, in our church, is we want to go from groaning because of the things that we're facing, that we rightly should be groaning about, to longing for God's presence. To be like Moses that says, God, if you don't go with us, don't send us. If you're not there, I don't want to go. Right? I'll go anywhere, God, if you're going with us. But if you're not going, I don't want to go. I don't want to go anywhere without you. That's why we're having this series. That's why we're having that day of prayer in June, so that we can continue to cry out to God. For the things that were mentioned earlier in the message, for the other needs that our church has, for the needs that you have in your lives, for all the things that we're praying and asking God for. So will you pray with me? Would you just begin to ask God to increase your longing for his presence, to increase it in your heart, longing for more of God? I know you have situations that you're facing, but Jesus taught us to seek first the kingdom. All the other things would be added on. Seek first the kingdom. He says, your Father knows you need these things. He knows you need clothes. He knows you need a roof. He knows you need shelter and food. And so let's start by saying, Father, will you increase the longing in my heart? And if you know much about the Bible, there are verses that might come to your mind, like I just thought of, as the deer pants for the water, so my soul longs after you. Right? Asking that desire, that panting, that thirst, and that hunger for God's presence, for his glory, for his face, for a face-to-face relationship with him like Moses had. Father, would you increase that in each of us right now? And then, Father, I know that there are needs, there are situations that we are facing, or that some of us are facing. And they're groaning and crying out to you. If we haven't been groaning, if we've been grumbling, Father, forgive us and help us be mindful, careful, and now begin to grab a hold of you, to groan, to cry out, to not let you go until you answer, Father. Because you are the same God that answered when Israel cried out to you. So answer us as we cry out to you. And keep us to be disciplined in the crying, in the groaning, in the longing for your presence. As we sing, I just want to encourage you, if you want, the altar is always open. If you want to come and bring your, whatever it is you're facing, just lay it at the altar. I encourage you to do that. So let's stand and let's pray.